I think we'll just carry on. So I'm Andy, for those who don't know me. Welcome to those online, too, if we have anyone online today. And I was going to say congratulations for remembering to change the clocks. If anyone walks in half an hour's time, please don't laugh at them. Be sympathetic. Some people might have forgotten. Okay, so today we are continuing our series in John. But we're going to start with a quick question. I wonder if you can tell me what these three people have in common. What do these three people have in common? It's good going, good going. You had a struggle to meet all three. Any ideas? Sorry, was that? Yeah, but a specific thing that they both did. Look at that. Very good, Anne. They have all conducted a famous interview with royalty. So, Martin Bashir famously interviewed Diana, Princess of Wales. That was back in 1995. It was watched by over 200 million people, that interview. Emily Maitlis famously interviewed Prince Andrew in 2019. Another interview with fairly big consequences. And Pilate, whose trial of Jesus reads a bit like an interview. And I would say that is by far and away the most read and considered interview in history. And that's the one that we're looking at today. So we're in week two of a two-parter. Last week, we saw the Jewish leaders bring Jesus to Pilate, looking for a death sentence. Israel is under Roman occupation, and only the Romans have authority to execute. Pilate questions Jesus to find out why people are calling him the King of the Jews. He doesn't begin to grasp the true nature of Jesus' kingdom, but equally, he doesn't find Jesus to have done anything wrong, so Pilate tries to set him free. The Jewish leaders are having none of it. They persist in clamoring for Jesus' death. And that's where we've got to. Now we're going to read part two of this interview with Pilate. It's on page 1027 of the Church Bible, so please do grab a Bible from in front of you, behind you, around you somewhere. Turn to page 1027. It's John chapter 19. We're going to start reading from verse 1. And then once we've read it, please keep it open so you can refer back. And Sally is going to read this for us.
So starting at verse 1. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. The soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head. They clothed him in a purple robe and went up to him again and again, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they slapped him in the face. Once more, Pilate came out and said to the Jews, "Look, I am bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him." When Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, Pilate said to them, "Here is the man." As soon as the chief priests and their officials saw him, they shouted, "Crucify, crucify." But Pilate answered, "You take him and crucify him. As for me, I find no basis for a charge against him." The Jews insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid, and he went back inside the palace. "Where do you come from?" he asked Jesus. But Jesus gave him no answer. "Do you refuse to speak to me?" Pilate said. "Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin. From then on, Pilate tried to set Jesus free, but the Jews kept shouting, "If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about noon. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Take him away, take him away, crucify him." "Shall I crucify your king?" Pilate asked. "We have no king but Caesar," the chief priests answered. Finally, Pilate handed him over to them to be crucified.
Superb. Thanks, Sally. Okay, do you see how the choreography here adds to the drama? Jesus is taken into Pilate's palace, but the Jewish leaders don't follow because they don't want to be ceremonially unclean for the Passover. So the interview happens largely in private, maybe with some other Roman officials around. Pilate goes backwards and forwards between Jesus and the Jews, the Jewish leaders, getting increasingly exasperated. Note that Pilate declares Jesus as King of the Jews five times. Five times. He might not realize quite what he's saying, but John wants us to know that Jesus is King. He's made that quite clear throughout his account of Jesus' life, and he doesn't hold back in the irony of the Jewish leaders rejecting Jesus as King, while the pagan ruler declares it again and again. Jesus is no threat to Pilate, as he's not looking to overthrow any political order. And he doesn't seek riches or wealth. Yet Jesus is King. He's a completely different king to any the world has known. He's the suffering servant king. So here's what we're going to see today. That Jesus is our King who suffers innocently. Jesus, our King, suffers intentionally. And Jesus, our King, suffers in our place. Now, did you notice how many times Pilate gives his verdict that Jesus is innocent? You may remember from last week, it's in verse 38, if you've still got your Bibles open, of chapter 18, Pilate declares, "I find no basis for a charge against him." Verse 4 today, "I find no basis for a charge against him." Verse 6, "I find no basis for a charge against him." The repetition is deliberate. This is the judge. Pilate is the governor, and he's used to trying people. In fact, he's used to executing people. But John wants the reader to be in no doubt that Jesus has done nothing wrong. The Jewish leaders first bring Jesus to Pilate without a proper charge. So Pilate presumes it's because of his claim to kingship, but he quickly rejects that. We saw that last week. The leaders then land on a charge of blasphemy, saying Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. Now this causes Pilate a bit more concern, probably because he's heard something about the many miracles that Jesus has done, and perhaps also because of the dream that his wife's had about Jesus, and you can read about that in Matthew's account. But again, Pilate rejects it. We read that Pilate tried many times to set Jesus free. We even see Pilate's various attempts to placate the crowd. He tries to free Jesus by use of a tradition around the time of year, but the crowd asks for Barabbas. Then Pilate has Jesus cruelly flogged, beaten, and mocked. Now, for those who are interested, apparently the Romans had three grades of flogging. And here it's probably just grade one. It's no small deal, but it's not the gruesome kind of near-death experience that Jesus would have endured later. Yet even when Pilate presents Jesus as the man, blooded, weak, and pathetic, the crowd still bays for his death. Eventually, the Jewish leaders land on the charge of sedition, so that Jesus is a threat to Rome. Anyone who claims to be a king opposes Caesar, they say. And they add to it, importantly, a personal threat to Pilate that unless he acts, his personal reputation is at risk. Now, just to be clear, the Jewish leaders have no loyalty to Rome. But at this stage, they're willing to say anything to get Jesus killed. Most shocking of all, they even declare that they have no king but Caesar. This really is outrageous. The Jewish scriptures are clear that they have one king who is God. They are God's chosen people. He is their king. So this is a moment of really terrible blasphemy, of apostasy by the Jewish leaders. And it's a really damning indictment of their blindness to what's happening. John wants us to know for sure that Jesus is innocent. And that's really important for something we're going to come back to later. But I don't think we should just lay the blame for Jesus' death at the feet of the Jewish leaders. Yes, they manipulate Pilate until they get what they want. But the crowd also go along with it. And in the end, although Pilate has the power to stand up for justice, he tries three times to get Jesus freed. He doesn't in the end. The soldiers treat Jesus ruthlessly, and Jesus' own followers have all run away. So I think we can say that at this point in time, fear is ruling the day. Pilate acts in the end out of fear. The Jewish leaders want Jesus dead out of fear. The crowd are no doubt fearful of their religious leaders. Jesus' followers have fled in fear. Fear, or self-preservation, is triumphing over truth. And I wonder how often we see that reflected in our world. So many of the major conflicts around the world seem to be started by fear. You could say Putin's attack on Ukraine was motivated by fear. Israel's attacks in Gaza or Lebanon, motivated by fear. Trump's attack on Iran, motivated by fear. Those in power knock others down, whoever they perceive to be as a threat. For people like us, or like the crowd and Jesus' followers, how often are opportunities to act for justice neglected out of fear? John wants to show us that all are involved here. Religious, secular, those who hold power, and those who live under it. The innocent suffering of the servant king implicates the whole of humanity. So Jesus goes to the cross innocently. He also goes intentionally. Now, we saw this a few weeks ago where John emphasized that throughout these whole events, Jesus remains in control. In fact, 700 years before this trial, God spoke through his prophet Isaiah to describe exactly what would happen. I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting. He was despised and rejected by mankind, a man of suffering and familiar with pain. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, yet who of his generation protested? He was assigned a grave with the wicked, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. So those words written 700 years before about what would happen to Jesus. God's intention was for his servant king to suffer. And note the nature of that suffering. It's physical. Protestant churches, I think, have often downplayed this, perhaps in response to the Catholic Church focusing on it, certainly focusing on it more. But the physical brutality suffered by Jesus is undeniably there. The New Testament writers don't go into lots of detail, but there's flogging. The thorns are thrust into Jesus' head. The beatings, the excruciating flogging that Jesus would have suffered just before his crucifixion. And then the unimaginable pain of the cross. There is a lot of physical suffering. But it's also relational. Jesus was abandoned by those he loved. He was abused. He was let down by those who helped him, who could have helped him. And it's emotional. He was mocked and despised. He was presented to the crowds to be ridiculed and scorned. God's intention was for his servant king to hold almighty divine power and yet to be pitifully powerless. God was made flesh, and here we see that flesh at its most weak. At Christmas, we celebrate that God is with us, Emmanuel. At Easter, we celebrate God for us, the innocent servant king who took on flesh intentionally to suffer and die. Which brings us to the third point, that Jesus suffers in our place. John narrates his account of Jesus' trial and execution with two key references. The first is hinted at in verse 14, where John reminds us that it was the day of preparation of the Passover. The Passover was when the Jews remembered how God had saved them from death in Egypt by killing a lamb and painting its blood on their doorposts. John wants us to see that Jesus is the substitutionary lamb who dies so that we might live. The other reference is again back to Isaiah's prophecy 700 years before. God says about his suffering servant in that prophecy, "Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering. Yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him, and afflicted." He, that's the suffering servant, Jesus, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Iniquity just means the broken nature of humanity or sin. The punishment that brought us peace was on him. Again, do you see the language of substitution? All our sin, all humanity's sin, deserves a punishment. And that punishment is death, but it is borne by God himself in Jesus on the cross. The innocent suffering servant, the pure Passover lamb, dies in our place that we might go free. So you see why the innocence is critical. If he wasn't innocent, then Jesus would be dying for his own sin. Jesus might pass through the judgment seat of Pilate, but he comes ultimately to the judgment seat of his heavenly Father, where he is condemned, but not for his own sin. It's entirely in our place. As the representative man for all mankind, he takes the punishment that we deserve. Peter was one of Jesus' followers, and when he writes later to the churches, he explains it as this. He says, Jesus died, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring you to God. So where does that take us? I wonder, does anyone know this man? Ooh, there we go. Not Peter, because I know you know it. Go on, Nate. Very good. Does anyone other than Nate know that that's Charles II? I'm impressed. Okay, that is Charles II. So in 1660, the people of England had a choice. They'd had 11 years as a republic under Cromwell. And in theory, at least, the people had ruled through the power of Parliament. There had been no king. The question that they now faced was whether they wanted a king. In particular, did they want Charles II as their king? Would they accept his authority? John has presented his account of Jesus' life and trial to lead us to a similar question. We've seen Jesus lauded and hailed as a miracle worker and as a teacher. We've seen Jesus oppressed and afflicted by those who were intent on rejecting him. John invites us to think, where would you have stood? Where do you stand as you read that account? He invites us to answer a key question, and I would say the key question of life. Do you accept Jesus as king, as your king? None of us gets to choose where we're born or the political regime into which we're born. To that extent, we're a name on a census and we pay our taxes as we're told. But there is a kingdom, not of this world, where the king doesn't just want our name or our taxes. He wants to take up residence in our lives. This king has suffered innocently, intentionally, and in our place to give us a new life. He wants us to receive him as king. He wants us to know him and to trust him as king. He doesn't just want our praises and hosannas, but he wants us to accept his authority over our lives. The biggest question that any of us will ever have to answer is, will you accept him as your king?